Thanks. Great. Hold on for a second. I'll go ahead and introduce you soon. So, great. Okay. So, Lu Pan is currently a postdoc at Harvard and is an expert in vision, both computer vision and in biological vision, which I don't know anything about, but he's an expert. So, I think that his plan is to talk about a couple things today, and one in each of those categories. I'm familiar with the computer vision work, which is very interesting, and I'm also looking forward to learning a little bit about the as well. So, welcome, Pat.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. I'm so very excited to share my work. So they're kind of old, my PhD works. I have some ongoing. I just finished my PhD last summer, so now I'm a postdoc. Yeah, let's see how it goes. Right, so I'll split my talk into two sections. So the first one is mostly about computational neuroscience. How so? There was a trend people have about comparing CNNs, brain visual cortex. So I also did some work on that line, and I guess coincidentally, I stumbled into Mackie Perturb work. So that's my second section about some feature interactions in humanities. But the both work are inspired by surround effects. So what is surround? So what are the surround effects? So your perception at some certain region is influenced by its surround. So for example, this is called tilt illusion. So if you keep your eye in the center of the left stimulus, so you might feel it's tilted a little bit to the right. But actually, it's up straight, like the one on the right. So this is an example of surround effects. And so people know that those surround effects can be very well accounted by a computation called surround normalization. So this is a very robust computation people have found in many brain regions. So people call it a canonical neural computation. So its formula is very similar to some types of normalization we saw in artificial neural networks, for example, LeerNorm. So the normalized response equals to unnormalized response of one neuron divided by the summation of a group of unnormalized response. So in the case of
Sorry, what's
surround
that
normalization,
sigma?
yes.
The sigma that you're adding on in
Yeah.
the denominator, what is that?
Oh, it's just like in layer norm, we have those small thing to avoid gradient explode. Yeah, in neuroscience models, people also have those things regulated not too hard, make it a smooth function. So on the left figure, this is a very classic surround effect that can be accounted by surround normalization. So what it shows you is on the x-axis is a diameter of this gradient stimuli. So as we increase the diameter of this gradient stimuli, and we recall from one neuron, you can see the neural response first increased, and then there's a non-monotonic trend, it decreased a little bit. I guess an intuitive way to understand this is at first, when the diameter is small, it only activates the center neuron. And when you get larger and larger, the surrounding neurons also get activated. Then it has a they have a suppressive effect on the center neuron. Okay. There are some theoretical works that show this type of surround normalization have a lot of benefits. I guess my favorite one is it has a very nice connection to efficient coding. So what efficient coding tells us is this is old idea given by Horace Burrow. So So sensory systems form the neural code for efficiently representing sensory information. I guess one way to interpret efficiency is they are less statistically dependent. I guess so I will show you briefly how to derive surround normalization from efficient coding. It's not directly related to my papers, but I think it's very nice piece of work. So first of all, what are the dependencies? Let me fix my zoom a little bit. It's blocking my. So what are the dependencies we can find in those linear filters? So once we characterize those dependencies, then we can find a way to reduce them. So here's an example. On the left is image. We pass it through two linear filters. Those are Gabor filters, very typical in both neuroscience and also CNNs, and we can get two activation maps. So we can see roughly two types of dependencies. The first type is there's some correlation between two activation maps. So for example, if we see some strong activation here, we also see some strong activation here. And another type of dependency is spatial dependency. So now we're looking at only one activation map, and we can find that some largest value and the smallest value, they are clustered in some specific regions. I don't know why it's keep glitching. Do you also see the glitch?
Mm-hmm, yeah. Is it glitching on your side?
Yes.
I don't know why. That's strange. You want to maybe stop sharing and start sharing again or something like that? No, who knows? I've never seen this glitching before.
It's hollow. It's a new phenotype.
Yeah.
Wait. What? It's getting worse. That's what I hear. Have a bigger problem now.
Oh no, what's wrong now?
I don't share.
It doesn't share your screen at all.
Okay.
It's the wrong one. Okay.
Let's see. Okay. So dependencies, spatial dependencies of those activation maps. Right, so if we draw the joint distribution of two neurons that are spatially apart a little bit, so we can see that there is a higher or second order dependency that isn't just simply correlation. That is, if one neuron's activation is large, then the variance of the other neuron is large.
Here. Are you full screen? Yeah, full screen. Strange, huh? I wonder why it's popping out of full screen like that. What if you just, okay, what if you make it not full screen? I don't know, I'm just trying different things. And well, I don't know what to do.
What are the different options in the view? This is full
screen. Do you think it's PowerPoint messing up or is it? Isn't that strange?
Let me try something. Maybe I can quickly upload this to Google Drive and use, I don't know.
present it this way.
It'll look ugly.
Yeah.
You didn't use presenter mode just by scroll through the slides.
Yeah, you want to just use it without presenter mode?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Yeah, let me first try disconnect. No, reset.
Oh, yeah,
because I'm not using.
That's right. Leave that off. That's it.
Yeah, this
problem. Yeah, okay. That's right. That's right. It keeps on trying to connect you to some other device.
Yeah.
You got it. You figured it out.
Okay. Now it's fixed. Okay, going back to dependencies. Okay, so we see those dependencies between two neurons. So now the problem is how can we reduce those dependencies? And there was a very nice line of work showing how to do this. So the goal is to go from left distribution to the right distribution. Then the neuron 2's distribution doesn't depend on neuron 1. And how to do this? And people find maybe go from left to right is hard, but go from right to left is easy. So you just multiply those Gaussian variables with a shared local scaling new random variable. And then you draw the activation of joint distribution of x, y, x2. It has this bow tie shape. So this is our generative model. Then we can reverse this generative model via Bayesian inference, and then we can get a form that is very similar to the surround normalization I just showed you. So the takeaway is surround effects or normalization indicates a reduction of coding redundancy. Okay, so those are the inspiration of all my works.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
So this is a histogram, right? Is that a 2D histogram of neuron 1 and neuron 2?
Yes, it's the joint distribution heat map, and on the top is histogram, yes.
I'm still having a hard time understanding what this plot is.
Oh, okay. If we look at one column of this heat map, that means conditional on neuron 1's activation at this level. What is the histogram of activation of neuron 2? So if neuron 1, if we conditional on neuron 1 has no value, maybe going back to this one, that means, so now two neurons are close to each other. Might be the definition of two neurons. So if neuron 1 is here, neuron 2 maybe is here. If neuron 1 has very low near zero activation level, then neuron 2 also have a very small variance. And if neuron 1 is here, you can see, then neuron 2 has a larger variance. If the activation level of neuron 1 is larger, then the variance of neuron 2 is also larger. So that's what this bow tie joint distribution. Does that make sense? Kind of.
So what's the difference between left plot and right plot? What's the right one?
Oh, right one is the desired joint.
Why is better?
So, why is it? Yeah, so yeah, explain the right one then.
Oh, okay. So the right one is regardless of the neuron 1's value, neuron 2's distribution is always the same.
So you're redefining neuron 2.
Yeah.
So let's bring up your formula. Right. Yeah, I'll show you had a formula.
Yeah.
Okay,
redefining, I guess, is after normalization.
Oh.
Yeah. Because here I also define redundancy as dependency.
Oh, okay.
So on the left, there's some dependency. So there's some redundancy.
So is the way to think of it is on the right, you're plotting G1 versus G2.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Left is X.
So your G1 is your desired latent variables that are underlying the physical neurons.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
And you're saying G1 and G2 are more uncorrelated.
Yep.
And so they don't have this relationship between the two things.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. That you're looking for statistical independence.
Yes. Yep.
So by neuron, you mean like the filters, two different filters, or is it spatially two?
Both actually. They can be different filters at the same location. It can be like your center field of view, this Gabor filter, and another same type of filter, but next to the first one. Yeah, both that.
Okay.
Yeah, and as I said, that there was a trend like 5 years ago or 6 years ago, people comparing CNNs with visual cortex and find a lot of surprising alignment between the two systems appearing different systems.
So actually, can you so let's finish the story. So with this translation to the space of G1 and G2, you have maybe this more desirable property of better statistical independence. So is the overall story that, you know, is the hypothesis that an efficient neural network will encode things using encodings like G1 and G2 rather than X1, X2? Is that the hypothesis or?
Yes, yes, yes. Uh-huh. So I guess one way, I guess there are two views. One is computation is divisive computation. Another view is, if we have this computation, what effects we can see? For example, the tilted illusion or the surround suppression effect. That's the phenomenon of that
right.
Induced by the computation.
So you're saying that if the computation is expressing everything in terms of G1, G2, then you'll probably see surround effects and
yeah.
these normalization effects
right.
and so on.
Yeah,
that's right.
Oh,
so and that's evidence that biology is probably using G1, G2,
yes.
not X1, X2.
Yes, yeah.
Right.
So in
okay.
biology, actually it's more well known that those neurons probably is using G1 and G2. That's more known in neuroscience.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm looking for this effect in also in CNNs. That's my first.
Got it. Now I understand. Okay.
Yeah, so people find Gabor filters in both CNNs and V1, and they also created a metric called representational dissimilarity matrix, and find that in early layers of CNN is similar to early visual areas, and in later layers in CNN is similar to like later visual areas. Yeah. So there was a hype comparing the two systems. So here, I want to compare the two, but with the scope of surround effect. So does CNN show surround effect? But in neuroscience, people know it's very robust. how about CNNs? So the first experiment I did, sometimes people refer this method as in silico electrophysiology, which I replicate as similar as what people does in animals. But I record from artificial neurons. So in this experiment, so this is animal data. We have three types of stimuli. We can put the gradient stimuli only in the center and rotate this gradient stimuli to have different orientation. And this is a black line here. Each neuron has an optimal orientation, and I align those optimal orientation at zero orientation here. And the second type of stimuli is we only put stimuli outside of what people call classical receptive field in the surround region and rotate this surround or gradient. And because it's outside of classically defined receptive field, by itself, it doesn't elicit any interesting response. So it's a flat line, purple line here. Yeah, just checking if you can see my mouse. Yeah, but itself doesn't elicit any interesting behavior, but if we combine the two, there are some very interesting effects. So now in the cyan stimuli, we fix the center stimuli at its optimal orientation and rotate the surround. And what people find that the surround can elicit a strong inhibition when it's aligned with the center gradient orientation. And if it's different from the center orientation, it has a sometimes it can even have a facilitation effect, at least like it.
Okay.
I did the same experiment in same neurons and found very similar trend. So the takeaway is the most suppressive surround breeding matches the optimal orientation in the center. Those are in the artificial neuron. And then I was inspired by this famous Chris Ola post on future visualization. So I asked myself, can I go beyond grading stimuli and show this surround suppression, but with small complex textures stuff? So I modified this approach a little bit into a two-step visualization. So very much like the grading experiment, first I look for the, I constrain my search space of optimizing the input image to only optimize this center region and find the optimal center texture. And then I can branch in two different directions, which I ask, what is the most suppressive surround and what is the most facilitative surround? And I find that the most suppressive surround looks very similar to the center stimuli. But the most facilitative surround, the URA look very different from the center. So this is kind of a generalization of the grading stimuli I showed. So now it's not the orientation is my parameter, but the texture stuff is my parameter.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
So what do you mean by suppressive surround?
Suppressive surround is when the surround when the surround stimuli is shown with the center, it inhibits the activation when the center shows by itself. So like here, when this is the cyan stimuli here. So when the surround is combined with the center, and when they are aligned, the orientation is aligned, it suppresses this black activation from here to here.
So is your experiment set up by analogy when it's the same feature in the surround? So you know you could have all sorts of different signals in the surround, but you're asking when it's the same feature in the surround. Is that right? You're measuring the effect of
The surround is optimized. It's visualized. It's not I have copied the center texture to the surround. It's I set the optimization target as the negative activation of this neuron. And I look for the surround.
Oh, you're looking for a suppressive surround.
Yeah.
And then sometimes you find one. And then sometimes there's no suppressive surround. Is that right?
Yeah.
That's
yeah, but I we had a measure and we show that they are statistically significant. That we have a measure of how similar the surround is to the center.
I see, okay.
Can I ask another question?
Sure.
Are these surround specific classes? For example, like a dog class, it will have one type of surround. And for a cat class, it will have another type of surround. Or like it's texture based.
It's I did this experiment per neuron. So I guess at that time, since they have privileged bases, so we can treat each neuron as a feature or something. So this experiment is done per neuron. And I screened all the neurons and did statistical.
So it's not class-based?
Class-based. If it's last layer, it's class-based, right? But if it's middle layer, it's hard to say. Right? It's more of a, like a middle layer feature.
Draw the analogy from the toy setup you had, the different sort of features you had between neuron 1 and neuron 2. So ideally, you do not want to see this in a neural, like in an optimal neural. That
no, this is desired. This effect indicates there are some surround normalization inside network, and those surround normalization is good.
It's good, but
yeah, it's
is
optimized.
There a statistical
It makes neurons more independent. So it's reducing the redundancy of neural code. So it's a desired computation, and this effect is an indication there are something similar to this computation in this neural network.
So I'm noticing that the, what did you call the red ones, the facilitative ones, are usually like high contrast colors
Oh yeah.
with the center. Is that pretty typical across most of the
Yeah,
examples?
it's very. Right, so the here I guess the texture features are you can look for like spatial frequency, the color, or the shape. Right. The facilitative ones have contrastive frequencies, colors, and shapes.
What is you're showing some images on the right hand side. What's showing on the right hand side?
Those are the optimal patches for this neuron.
Oh wait, hold on for a second. So every row is one neuron?
Oh yeah. Every three or four panels is a neuron. Like this is a neuron.
Oh, I thought that these were many different. I thought every square was a neuron. So, but the, you're saying that the blue column is suppressive? I'm trying to understand. So,
Okay. Yeah.
so I'm
Maybe
trying
go
to
back
understand. So
to.
you're, are you finding that neurons, that some neurons have suppressive behavior and some neurons don't, or
Okay,
that's what I didn't
no,
understand.
yeah, maybe this will explain.
Well, the most, oh, it's you're measuring the surround for a single neuron.
So these three panels are for one neuron. So I pick a neuron, I optimize only the center image.
Got it.
So target is activation of the
Yes.
neuron. And then I set my optimization parameter or variable to the surrounding area. Look for surround, fix the center. I find the center, I fix the center, I look for surround. And the optimization target now is either the same as before activation or the negative of the
I
activation.
understand now.
Okay. So
Yes.
each neuron, optimal center, most suppressive surround, and the most facilitative surround.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
So is there a chance that a particular neuron that is contributing to the suppressed surround can also switch mode and become what do you call it? Facilitating surround?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. I guess what I can answer is most neurons, if the center texture is its optimal stimuli, then the most suppressive surround is similar to the center. I guess in some special cases, if we switch the center to something else, then we ask what is the most suppressive surround. It could be different, I guess. Okay, so here are more examples. So this is an eye neuron. I guess the most suppressive surround for this eye neuron are multiple eyes. And same for those more complex color combinations or the shapes like this triangle or maybe lines in the middle. Okay. Second part of simulation. So this is very similar to the first one, but now people shift the center orientation not to be the optimal orientation of this neuron, but for example here, 45 degree off its optimal orientation and rotate the surround gradient. And people find that very interestingly, the most suppressive surrounding orientation matches the center orientation. So it's a dynamic, adaptive way. So the most suppressive surround is not always this orientation. It changes as you change the center. So I did similar in silico experiment and find in some later layers of VGG, it has this trend. Then the question is, how can I visualize this effect? Then I need to change.
So in silico, are you picking a specific neuron to look at, or how did you?
Oh, it's average across all the neurons.
Interesting. Great. So you're not looking for a specific edge detector.
Yeah.
You're
no.
You're just looking at the dominant behavior.
Yes. This is the average pair. But I do have a criteria to select neurons. So to do this experiment, I first need to get the classical receptive field size of this neuron by measuring some tuning curves. Some neurons have too small or too large, this classical receptive field, so I exclude those neurons. As long as this neuron has a decent classical receptive field, I include this neuron. And this is average.
Cool.
So in a sense, like, it kind of depends on our definition of classical receptive fields. Like,
definitely.
If it's a feed-forward network, then if it's truly feed-forward and we measure the gradients passing and then there's nothing information passing outside that field, then there's no surrounding effect. But if you define it more restrained to the center, then you have a surrounding effect because we define it that way.
Yeah. This is a very good question. So in CNN, we have a hard boundary for each neuron.
Yeah.
We know that this is a hard receptive field. But here, my classical receptive field is defining similar to people do in neurophysiology. They have their definition of this. Yeah, it's related to the size tuning curve. As you increase the size, as I show you, the response first increase, then decrease. And the classical receptive field people define is around the peak diameter of that curve. Right, so I want to generalize this experiment to texture. So I need to change the center not to be this neuron's optimal center stimuli. So I have two ways to change it. So first I permute the color of the center stimuli. So for example, for this neuron, this is one neuron. And now you should look at each column now. So the first column is the original experiment. So I optimize for the center and look for the most suppressive surround. And what now I do is I permute the color channels to have a different set of center stimuli now and use those permuted centers to look for the most suppressive surround. And I find that the surround color can adapt to the change in the center. And there's statistics in the paper, but this is a statistically significant effect. Okay. And the second one I alter the center is I swap the center texture completely with some other neurons optimal center. And I look for the most suppressive surround. Not for all the neurons. For some neurons, it has ability to even adapt the texture in the surround to the center texture.
Okay. Interesting. So you're suppressing this neuron even in this situation, even though the stimulus you're providing to the neuron doesn't correspond to its optimal stimulus, but the suppressive one, it's an interesting contextual situation.
Indeed. Yes.
Yeah. Was this seen in biology as well?
So I draw the analogy from this grading experiment. So I don't think people have done much like texture complex stimuli in biology. So yeah, so I also try to sell this paper as predictions to brain behavior. So people can look for those things.
Cool.
Okay. Great. Yeah, that's my first section. So yeah, and then the next thing to do is VIT. So VIT came out, I need to learn VIT and see if I can find any this effect in there. But I approached the idea in a different way. I didn't want to do the exact same experiment in IT, so that also caused me to stumble into the microbiology field. Anyway. So the first thing I tried, or the first question I asked is, are there more attention assigned to similar or dissimilar tokens? I guess there are several motivations. So I guess one motivation is there was a debate. I don't know if it's popular or not, but some people claim that attention, people call attention in transformers, but those attention are very different from human attention. And there is a paper showed transformer attention is doing grouping rather than highlighting the salient sets. So there are more attention assigned to similar types of tokens. I looked at those papers, but I feel their design isn't very optimal, so I try to answer this question use some better designs, also by my own. So I looked attention map first. So okay, first of all, this data set. This data set is very interesting. It's called alt one out data set. So it has two categories of objects in each image. So one category is a singleton. So for example, here is a white duck. And another category of a group of objects, here is a brown duck. So I pick a token in one category and draw the attention map of this token and see if its attention map aligns more with itself or with other types of tokens. So I saw some effects that in most VITs, especially those classical ones, not the mask reconstruction ones. In early layers, there are more attention on the same objects. But in later layers, actually attention is more distributed to different objects. Anyway. So this is empirical finding. So the next thing
Is the y-axis just averaged attention over all the heads?
Yes, it's averaged across heads. And yes, across head and different images for sure, and also across types of objects. Yeah.
Same object means the same one or like same type of things?
Same type. Yeah, because the mask is, so how I calculate is the alignment between the mask and the attention map.
So is there a way of looking at this result and seeing, can you distinguish between the odd one out phenomenon here and just locality, that at early layers attention is just attending to patches that are closer, and at later layers attention is things that are just further?
Interesting. So you are saying this effect could be simply explained by the distance between. I couldn't answer. I didn't try that, but I doubt it's merely the business. Yeah, I don't know.
Okay.
Anyway. Right. So this is empirical. So the next thing I tried to do is, can I show this effect in a more principled way by looking at the ways of the computations of VIT or attention? Right. So this is the attention formula we are familiar with. I guess I don't know, I should say I discovered independently as those Anthropic work, I found the QK matrix, they always go together. So Anthropic called this QK circuit. And the token interaction is only determined by this one matrix, which is the product of the two. That's a very simple bilinear form. So I probably can answer those attention similar dissimilar question only looking at this matrix. So to analyze this matrix, so I did singular value decomposition. So decompose this Y matrix into a set of left, right singular vectors and singular values. So this singular value decomposition method has a very nice natural interpretation. So that is, so this is very important. So that is, if one token's embedding is aligned with one left singular vector, then this token only attends to tokens that has projections onto its corresponding right singular vector. Because this is because the orthogonality of singular matrices. So you could think of those are independent interactive modes. So we have, in a typical VIT, we have 64 modes or channels of those interacting feature pairs. So another way to see that is it can be thought of as a left single vector query looking for its right singular vector key. Okay, so now I can answer the same question. Do tokens attend to similar tokens or dissimilar tokens by measure the cosine similarity between the left singular vector and right singular vector? If they are similar, the left singular vector and right singular vector, if they are the same similar, then also means tokens tends to attend to similar tokens. So this is a average cosine similarity measure between left singular vector and right singular vector. There is an even more clear trend that in early layers, tokens tends to attend similar tokens, and in later layers, tokens attend to dissimilar tokens. So the conclusion here is attention prefers similar tokens in early layers. I couldn't see my next slide, so I don't want to expect. But anyway, that's it. Oh, okay.
Sorry. So this is weighted by the singular values?
Yes, exactly. All right. Okay, so from here, my exploration branched out to two directions. So this part isn't showed in my paper. Also, I don't have a plan to write it down. I feel like it's a little bit different story than the main story I tell you in the paper. But anyway, if you think this is interesting, we can try to push it if you want. I'm happy to hand this over. So what's the story? So I try to visualize those singular vectors. Now I've realized I'm not picking one token. I'm optimizing the activation of activation, I mean embedding projection onto those singular vectors for the whole image. So on the left are some early features, on the right are some late layer features. I guess one very interesting thing I saw is in some early layer, there are some odd patches, so it's not homogeneous. So if this vector represents some texture, then why it isn't this texture everywhere, but only most places, but there are some holes. So this is a very robust effect. I saw almost in, I don't know, all the vectors, but 80% of those vectors have those holes. See, this is very interesting. So I looked deeper why there are those holes. Okay, so this is what I did. So I pick a vector, I optimize its input, and see its activation map. Okay, those holes have very low values, right? If my optimization target is the sum of the activation of the whole map, the why is those are those pixels patches are not optimized. Then I try to patch those holes with the texture I copied from the other place to fix those holes. Oh, the interesting is the population activation is suppressed if I fix those holes. So those holes actually are necessary to induce a global high activation value. Okay, then I can start from here, continue optimize this image and see those holes emerge again. See those holes and to facilitate other tokens activation value. So the my conclusion is all patches are facilitative.
Where do you start the optimization of the input? Like, does it zero initialization?
No, it's a random noise, Gaussian noise.
And when you say optimize further, what are you optimizing there? Is it just maximum?
Maximum the sum of token embedding onto this singular vector.
So you're optimizing to try to make all the tokens in the image as similar as possible to your target vector.
Yes.
I see another setup is like you just hook like the central token and then optimize that ones. And I think the prediction is like you will see this kind of in the surrounding or something.
Oh yeah,
somewhere else.
But... yeah, I don't remember my next slide, but you remember me. This is the next one.
Yeah.
Okay. So this is if I only optimize for the center token, then these old patches are everywhere in the surround.
Wait, can you say that again?
Oh, okay. So the above three panels, optimization target is the sum of all the tokens projection or whatever. And the bottom one is the optimization target is only the center tokens projection on this singular vector. I don't care about other places, but they are all my observation variables.
So what did the heat map show again? The yellow heat map? Like what is that the value you're optimizing for? Or like
Yeah. So those are the value here, the color is tokens embedding projection on dot product the singular vector. Right. Okay. And is this texture effect generalized to objects? So I found a very interesting vector that is highlighted on the tokens a bird is standing on, like either a log or a wall or whatever. So I think this is connected to this idea because those birds, they don't activate this feature directly, but they are a necessary condition for this wood or branch, whatever, to be activated.
You mean if there's no bird in the image, then the log
won't
is not activated?
No, that's my hypothesis. I didn't do that experiment. This is not published. It's not a serious thing, but some preliminary. If you want to explore more, I'm happy to hand it over. And if I optimize this wood feature, there might be a bird here. Okay.
Do you find one that's like the opposite, that fires on birds when there's like something they're standing on? It seems like you'd want the opposite of this if you're trying to detect birds, right? Like you don't want to, or maybe this is like a we want to suppress this later or something. But
Yeah,
like we don't
I
care
see
about
a lot
the.
of birds' features, but I don't really notice or pay attention to if there's a.
It just seems like this is something you'd want to suppress at some point of like we don't care about the fence that the bird is standing on, you know. So maybe this is like we're finding the things that we don't care about
Oh.
to get rid of it later or something. That's very cool.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a very interesting hypothesis. By the way, this feature is found in the right before the self-attention layer. So it's not the MLP like the side chain. You have those like delayed some information from the data bus. That's, but could be related. Yeah.
Encounter these features just coincidentally or just do some SAE stuff.
I was looking at all the vectors features, and this one is quite striking because there's very obvious bird here, but the feature isn't the bird. So this is very, I don't know, at least very significant to me. Just catch my eye.
What model is this?
I believe this is VIT, original VIT.
Is ImageNet trained?
Yeah, that's the side story. So the story I'm going to tell you is the story in the paper. That is, those singular vector pairs are very semantically meaningful. So this is one of the figures in the paper. So the first row is a vector in a mode, a singular mode in VIT, and the bottom row is Dino. So there are two models. So in the paper, I showed, I guess, four models, also Blape and DIT. All of them, I can find some very meaningful singular vector pairs. So I think it's very interesting because they here, those singular modes, they segment the image, but in a different way or highlighting different parts. So this query, so red means query direction, and cyan is the k direction. So on top row, it looks like this query feature is the top of a cake, and the k feature is the bottom of a cake, and is invariant across different types of cake. Yeah, chocolate cake, yeah, cheesecake or cupcake. Yeah, and the bottom one is even more fascinating to me. It's like the query is whatever object held by a person, and the key is the person itself, or the hand, or that's mostly the arm and the skin part of this person. So I had a hypothesis. Again, I didn't test deeply. It's just a hypothesis I said in the paper. Why there's a mode like this? So there are some information flows from this person to the object. So my hypothesis is, there is an attribute, something like being held, is added to this object. It could be a circuit.
Cool.
Okay, so the next one is more those modes. So from early layers to late layers. So early layers, we can expect there are like simple color features or texture features. Also, as the story I just told you, they tend to align because tokens in early layers tend to similar tokens. For example, here, the white actually means those red and cyan overlaps. So that's why it's gray or white. And as you go deeper, it has more interesting interactions. Okay, so this is also a sad story. I didn't investigate very deeply, also not in the paper. And I found that, for example, this car image activate a mode, and this mode looks like it's universal to both car and animals, even different animals. So the red part is the top of this animal or car, and the cyan or the overlap part is the bottom of this car or animal. And the bottom row is even more interesting because it's even segmenting the legs of animal or the fin of a fish and the wheels of a car. So yeah, I think this is similar to those dino papers they showed originally in their paper. They showed, okay, this eagle wing and body feature also transferred to those airplane wings and bodies. But here, I guess what I added is those parts do interact strong. Another sad story I find is interesting, again, I didn't dig too much, is what is the negative direction of a feature? So because singular value decomposition, the sign of those singular vectors are arbitrary. So when I was looking for those features, I looked both directions. And one thing I find that is transformer do use both directions. Do use both directions. And sometimes those two directions are correlated. So for example, I showed three examples here. It looks like, so for example, this cyan K feature on the positive direction, positive is arbitrary, so I define positive direction is the nose of this dog. Then the negative feature of this nose feature is the body of a dog.
Mm.
Yeah. And the background of this query feature, I mean, the query feature here is the background, and the opposite of this background feature is the head of this dog. And similarly, on the second example,
so this positive and negative are one of the values. And it, do you show the corresponding key here or the corresponding paired feature? Right. So these are key query
yeah.
pairs, right? Is which? So I'm just trying to understand your thing. So is one of the, you're showing the positive and negative side of like the query vector.
Yeah.
Are you showing the key vector anywhere?
Yes. The sign is the key.
Oh, I see. So the
sign. You should compare this red with this red and this cyan with this cyan.
I see. Now, there's really four combinations of positive and negative. Are you showing? But you're just showing two?
No. Sorry. But, sorry. Uh-huh. Yeah. So the arbitrariness is in pairs. So if the one is flipped, then the other one also should be flipped. It's not like four combinations because.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the singular value decomposition.
And they have one singular value per pair of query key.
Yeah. You can think of you switch the sign of singular value, then you have.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. I see. So they're both flipped. I see. So at the top, it's the background versus the nose of the dog. Yeah. And at the bottom, it's
nose versus body.
Nose versus body.
Yeah, so if we trace the information flow, is the top one is information flow from nose to background, and here is from body to nose. So from body to nose, from nose to background. So it's like a chain effect. I don't know.
Interesting.
So these two directions are both valid in a sense. Like they can both be used by the natural.
Yeah. Yeah, to me, it's kind of intuitive. It makes sense because if we have two exclusive features, then we know for sure they couldn't overlap at one token. I guess the most efficient encoding is just use different sign because they never you could not ever compose them. They're not even, if you have one, this feature, you can go this direction. And if you, yeah, it's like a simple scaling set. Okay. I think that's all of my, ongoing projects. Yeah, after I moved to Harvard, I switched my interest to mostly on language models. I think, yeah, it's knowledge injection and contextual effects in LLM. We have some very interesting findings, which we don't really know how to understand it correctly, but I'm happy to discuss. I know your group, like Rome, Mammoth, it does the same thing, but I'm using a different method. It's a more global method rather than a targeted method. And I also see some very interesting contextual effects. I don't know how to explain, you know, happy to discuss. Also, another thing, this is collaboration with Bing Xu. Oh, by the way, this is Bing Xu. Introduce to everyone. She's also a fellow at Harvard Kempner Institute. Yeah, so we have a toy model, a different model. So the prompt is something like a blue square on top of a red circle, and it generates image like this. And now we're trying to dissect the circuits, why it knows which one is on top of which, like a classic Macintosh type of circuits. Yeah, that's all the things I prepared. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Questions, discussions. Oh, by the way, I plan to stay here longer, so I'm very happy to talk to everyone.
We didn't have a sign up sheet.
Yeah, no, we the idea was we could do a group discussion. I do know people who want to talk one to one, so if we have
experience. So we'll just do that informally, yeah.
Yeah. Great. That's good.
Yeah, but like I guess tomorrow is in an hour, so if you wanted to have like a single discussion, a one to one with him.
Yeah, I can do that. Yeah,
and then after that, then we can do
like, yeah, that's great. In general. And any questions for Penn before we?
I'm really interested in the relation thing, but maybe I can just ask you about that.
No, go ahead.
I just want to know like what you've been trying to do or what you've done so far.
Oh.
Yeah.
So first thing we do is, I guess our strategy is first find features and then try to connect those features, right? So the this diffusion relation, right?
Yeah, the second one.
Yeah. So first we use something not like as a sparse autoencoder. We use a simpler, we think it's more straightforward way to find those features, but just contrastively learn, okay. We have a new way to discover those like blue object, or it's a square or a circle. So first we find those features. And then we have we hypothesized two circuits that can implement the positions. So for example, one object, if we have in the early stage of this diffusion, we have a blob, and this blob first attend to the positional information on top here, because it has like the top positional encoding. It knows, okay, if I'm on the top and I see on the top, then I should attend to the left word to the on the top. And then in the next layer, it attends to the first word and gets the attributes from the first word, turn itself into a blue square. So that's one circuit, and we have another alternative circuit.
Can I ask a question?
In this setting, this is a diffusion model that you trained, right? So on toy data, right? So
yes.
It's like a small data set. Yep. Go ahead.
So what if I have one diffusion model that says a blue square on top of a circle, not a circle, on top of a circle, and I have a separate run where I say that like just a circle, then I compose the scores of the diffusion and get the same output. I'm wondering how does compositional, how how different would the circuit be when I'm trying to compose two diffusion inferences versus a single run?
Oh, that's very interesting. So I guess you are talking about like with guidance or with weak guidance or with strong guidance, and how the circuit is different if the guidance is different.
If you have a single run, how would the neural network solve the same problem when I'll have two square functions, as you said, like a guidance? So I was wondering, like, how, like if you have any plan on trying to understand the compositionality of the diffusion model as opposed to just like a single run, because I think one of my lab mates did a research where they found that when you're trying to compose separate scores, you get better results than if you have a single run.
Yeah. By composing, you mean like averaging
discourse.
Just adding them?
Yeah, adding them. So if you might have a single inference where you were saying that, okay, a blue square on top of a circle, and then you have a separate run on just a circle. And when you compose those two scores together,
I believe
it might have the same output. So if it has the same output, how does composition affect the circuit opposed to having a single run?
So the normal like classifier-free guidance is kind of a special case of this? Like,
right. Yeah.
Like the positive
This is
we did an analysis on the classifier-free guidance case, which you have the positive problem and the negative problem of messing. So you can compare the circuitry in both cases and then So it's kind of funny, like the negative prompt is like more treating this thing more like a vision model. It's kind of like text-free, but you're mostly observing what is happening. And the text-rich case is kind of adding things to it and moving information. So again, there's something different in the cases, and comparing between them can find some feature that is maybe like text-specific and some is not. So, but we haven't finished that part yet.
How do you find circuits in a multi time step inference?
We did it like basically each time step we train a different feature model and see how it changes through
every single time step. How many time steps are you dealing with?
So this kind of model, we are doing like PixArch, right? And it's like 14 times. I mean, there's 1,000 in total, but it's kind of continuous function. So we basically sample 14 different sampling steps. So it's good, and also it's changing very smoothly across time. So it's.
So do you find that that's really necessary? Do you find different circuits at every time step?
We have hypotheses that I think it's maybe not that necessary. Things are changing pretty smoothly. So, and also we find there's a, so the time modulation is through like just basically adding in. It's affine transform. So we guess maybe if we denormalize those parts, then it becomes much more stable, but we haven't really tested yet.
Yeah, it's interesting.
When you say it changes smoothly, do you mean the circuit changes smoothly or the output?
So more concretely, so if you do this kind of things and then you, so assuming this is like a VIP like transformer behind it, and you find the token corresponds to the blue stuff, and trace it across time, and then at each time steps, like you do a, for example, linear classifier to find the direction that predicts blue square, for example. And you find the direction, how it changed through time. And direction that predict the emergence of a blue square will change pretty smoothly.
On the same neural.
On the same token.
On the same token.
Yeah. But definitely there are some deficit or some bad things about this technique, like because things can happen different place across time.
So it changes a little bit. It changes slowly.
Yeah. There was a time, I mean, there was a moment in like the diffusion trajectory we find things suddenly change. So we think there may be some emergence things, like something decide to happen or something. I mean, there should be objects. So object should appear here, those kind of things.
Interesting. That's cool. Well, that's great. We'll wrap it up, and then we'll take a chance for everybody to talk to you know our presenters one on one. I'm gonna steal you for just a couple minutes, just to chat with you, and I'll let you guys chat with him a little bit later this afternoon.
I think we're done with Zoom.
Thanks everybody.
Great. Do you want to